by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We have one of the most powerful, unique, my gosh, talented writers, authors that we've ever had are interviewed before. His name is Daniel Estulin. He's written several books, I think about 16. Welcome to our program, Daniel Estulin.
Thank you so much, George. It's a pleasure and honor to be on your show.
I tell you what, that introduction was not, puffed. You are a heck of a good writer. And tell our listening audience a little bit of your background and what you've written in the past and so forth.
I've actually written 12 books, not 16. I hope to get to 16, but that's food for thought for later. I have 12 books.
12 books, I'm sorry.
My first book, which became an international bestseller, and that doesn't usually happen. Usually, you're supposed to get a few books under your belt, and then over time you start developing a fan base and a reader base. But in my case, the first book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, became an international bestseller, a runaway bestseller, I should say, that sold over 3.5 million copies worldwide in 64 countries. It has been translated into 42 languages. And in the United States, in English, it came out in 2007. Big publishers obviously wouldn't touch it. No one in England wanted to come anywhere near it. And then I found this small boutique publishing company in Portland, Oregon, called Trine Day. And this most eclectic, enthusiastic character I've ever met in my life, Chris Milligan, publisher.
Yes, Chris and I were together in Dallas last November 21st, and he brought Judith Baker in.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And he's an amazing knowledge of American history, and he certainly has an eye for the kinds of books that, you know, strike people's fancy, and Bilderberg, needless to say, became an international bestseller in the United States. But before that, it was a runaway bestseller. It was number one for over a year in Spain when it first came out. And I think the premise behind it, you know, just a little bit explain what, you know, what this whole Bilderberg story is about is, over the years, we always, hear about, coup d'etats and financial shenanigans, and somebody meeting someone somewhere, behind closed doors to plan some kind of financial operation. And then we see the results of this financial operation. And then somebody gets killed. And, we hear talk that maybe someone was actually killed because they did something that someone powerful didn't want done to them. Well, we didn't really know who these they were. We had no idea, no way to prove it until my book came out. Okay. And, What basically happened with The True Story of the Bilderberg Group is, the deeds, the events, the occurrences, the who, what, and the wheres, and the deliberation of the secret Bilderberg meetings, which I actually, the only person in the world to actually have infiltrated these meetings on two separate occasions. And suddenly, these they had a name and these they had a face. And we could put, photographs and documents and deliberations and, the whereabouts and the results of what these they did to the rest of us. And that's why, it also was accompanied by over 120 pages of documents and photos. So no one could call it a conspiracy theory. And people immediately said, yeah, now I understand how it works. But that said, I think people took this whole Bilderberg fascination a little bit too far. And now, I watched the last couple of, I watched, literally watched on TV, the last couple of Bilderberg meetings, because before I used to go every single year with my good friend Jim Tucker, who passed away last year, God bless his soul. And he and I would be the only journalists from anywhere in the world who, you know, if you don't count the ones who were actually on the inside, you know, deliberating with the Bilderbergers, who followed these meetings annually. And so when I saw him the last couple of years, you know, with all these people coming out and, you know, having their hot dog parties and, you know, and drinking parties and, you know, wearing Bilderberg, you know, No to New World Order t-shirts. And I kind of thought to myself, you know, it looks a little bit like the Woodstock Festival from the 1960s, where, you know, people are saying, well, you know, when I was like 25, 30 years old, way back when, I attended a Bilderberg party. And it kind of sounds all really, really silly, so I don't think I'll be going anymore to these. But also people, you know, I finally realized that they don't quite understand. I mean, I've written a book. So much of it is out right now that there's really no point of talking more about Bilderberg. But still people don't understand what it's about. They still think of it as you know, an all, you know, seeing eye, you know, the most powerful secret society in the world. And it's not. Bilderberg is not a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy reality. And, you know, it's important to understand that it was a very important element of the oligarchical structures of the period post-World War II, especially when the Bilderberg was founded back in 1954. So in the 50s and the early 60s, it was very important because the people who attended these meetings, you know, were the creme de la creme, you know, the top of the heap of the individuals who ran corporations and governments in the Western world. And what made them so ruthless and cruel and powerful is that they went through World War II, they went through World War I, they went through demand destruction of the Great Depression. And they were born, you know, before the turn of the century. And their families made their monies in the 1850s and 1860s like the Rockefellers did. So they had this pedigree, which a lot of these individuals today simply don't have. So, you know, Bilderberg, again, was important right after the war. And that in and of itself is a very important factor, because what it meant was that Bilderberg was a vehicle through which private, financier, oligarchical interests were able to impose their policies on what was nominally sovereign governments. And, you know, I guess the biggest scandal part of the Bilderberg conspiracy is that it was heavily populated by people who came out of the old World War II Nazi apparatus, and who were, like, for example, Prince Bernard, one of the founders of the Bilderberg Group, or Walter Hallstein, who became the first president of the European Commission, who was actually the key lawyer on whose judgment the entire policy of the concentration camps was written by Hitler. So these are the people who were not only Bilderberg, not only Nazis, but became part of the, you know, bureaucracy of the European Union post-World War II. So that was the scandalous element of the Bilderberg organization, that, you know, these Nazis who were basically cleaned up and dusted off and employed to become a hardcore Cold War anti-Soviet structure elements in the West. So I guess that, in a nutshell, is the Bilderberg organization and my first book.
Boy, that was a terrific description. It's turned into sort of a corporate type of fascism in a way, has it not?
It has always been that. You know, if you look at the people who attend these meetings, financiers, industrialists, bankers, politicians, business leaders of multinational corporations, presidents, prime ministers, finance ministers, you know, state secretaries, representatives of all the international organizations such as the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, Federal Reserve, you know, and so on and so forth. So, yes, it's corporate. And, you know, a lot of people talk about one world government. Okay? Right. Well, one world government is not exactly how it works. It's rather one world company limited, corporations.
I see.
More
yes.
power than any government on the planet. And that does make sense, you know, because if you go to, for example, the old, you know, Bilderberger meetings, you know, for example, back in 1968, Mont-Tremblant, Canada, George Ball, Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, with JFK and Lyndon Johnson, gave a presentation at that delivery meeting titled Internationalization of Business, where Ball defined what the new Bilderberg policy of globalization was going to be and how it would shape the policy of this international new world order. And what's interesting about it is, according to Ball, who, by the way, was one of the partners in Lehman Brothers at the time, is the idea is that nation states became outmoded. They are an archaic form of government. In a Malthusian world, they can be relied on to, you know, believe that the resources in their countries belong to the people. No. The people who run the world believe that the resources belong to them. And so what they needed to do is to create some new form of government that will be more likable and equitably distribute the world's resources to them. And that new form of government decided is the corporation. So that's where the whole idea of world company comes from. And so the idea would be that this world company would then become the new government. And if you look at the globalization, that's exactly what this is. You know, beginning in the late 1960s, into the 70s, into the 80s, the United States and the rest of the world was literally taken over by this rash of mergers, this ever larger consolidation of industrial companies, agricultural companies, financial corporations. And they were slowly building these giant cartels to the point where we see now, today, giant cartels which control the resources of the world and effectively running the world. So you have the bankers who run the corporations, the corporate cartels and the cartels controlling the necessities of life, and they're more powerful than the nation states. So this whole world company project, in a sense, is a return to the old days of the British East Indian Company with a more modern computerized face. What they've actually done is what they announced they would do. But they announced that they were going to do this in 1968, and if you look at what's happening today, they did exactly that. 68, 78, 88, 98, that's 45 years ago. And no one is paying attention. And again, the idea, the very structure of the nation state and the idea of common wealth or general welfare of a people represented the main obstacle against any attempt of freely looting the planet and represented the most important impediment to the creation of a neo-colonial world empire. You know, in other words, according to George Ball and others at these Bilderberger meetings, the resources in any one country do not belong to the country, but to the World Company Limited run by the elite. And so what you need is some new form of government that will be more equitably distribute the world's resources. Again, this is exactly what we're seeing right now.
Boy, that's very powerful. I guess that went along with the when they used to describe these corporations as multinational, then it was morphed into transnational, meaning that they were owned, beginning to be owned by internationalists, right? The globalization was coming online at that time.
You know, globalization is just another word for control.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If you want to talk about, an empire, for example,
right?
You know, and again, people understand empires in different ways. But an empire is not a king or a queen sitting on a gold-plated throne. Empires are above kings and queens. It's a system of control, okay?
Right.
Whose idea is these perpetual wars, you know, to make sure that the control is always in their hands.
Right. Your latest book is entitled Transevolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction. How did you begin to think in terms, did you get onto this through transhumanism or what? Tell us about how your thoughts, coalesced together to begin writing and thinking about this book.
You know, it actually, started back in 2005 when I got my hands on as a result of the people I knew, insiders, I guess you call them, at the Bilderberg Conference. When it happened in 2005, Bilderberg met at Brodahagen, which is one of the wealthiest little towns in the world. The population base, it's on the Lake Tuggernsee. A population base of Brodahagen, I think, is about 6,000 people. And you have the biggest concentration of billionaires there per square meter of space against any other town or city in the world. So, you know, it's a playground for the super rich. So at this Bilderberger meeting, after the meeting ended, you have this, you know, small, very powerful group of insiders, the inner circle, you know, the committee, who, when everyone else went home, they went to another meeting, even more secret meeting, which didn't include 95% of the Bilderberger attendees, to a castle in Bavaria. And at this meeting that lasted about 2.5 days, they put together what later became known as the Strategic Trends Report 2007-2036, which at the time was meant to be a secret source document on the future of humanity. When it came out in 2007, it was published, I think, in The Guardian, and, you know, it got all the, you know, the fanfare and, you know, became official when the British media carried it. I mean, you could download it now for free, but back then, nobody knew it existed. So this 91-page report became a blueprint for Britain's future strategic national requirements through the analysis of key risks and future shocks to the world's financial, economic, political, demographic, and technological areas and markets. And when I was reading the report, you know, at the time, the report, it's the final version, is 91 pages long, and I, at the time, you know, I got my hands on a 43-page brief, you know, rough draft, you would call it. And as I was reading this report, I thought to myself, this has nothing to do with the future. It has to do with the present. They're redefining what humanity is. And if you look at the other conferences, which over time morphed themselves, you know, with Strategic Trends Report into this one kind of a roadmap, there's this one called the Age of Transition. The other one is the Global Future 2045 International Congress. And then there's one NBIC conference whose ideas is to integrate humanity with nature to save the planet Earth from mankind. And the visions laid out of these conferences include robotics, cybernetics, artificial intelligence, life extensions, brain enhancement, brain-to-brain interaction, virtual reality, genetic engineering, teleportation, human-machine interfaces, neuromorphic engineering, and enhanced human capabilities for defense purposes. And one thing, you know, became obvious as I was reading this, that for the first time in history, the elite felt that they had a chance to steal the fire from the gods. And they certainly didn't want to, you know, turn away from it. What they wanted was a future in which technology and biology combined, leading to a promise of what they call singularity. And the singularity is an era in which the collective intelligence of mankind will become increasingly non-biological and trillions of times more powerful than it is today. The dawning, as they call it, of a new civilization through technological means, which will enable us to transcend our biological limitations and amplify our creativity, literally creating a new being. And what I realized reading this report is that the generation of children who are 15 to 20 today, this is the last truly human generation of beings on the planet Earth. Their offsprings, in other words, their children, their children's children, no longer be human. They will be transhuman. They will be post-human. They will be man-machine. They will be cyborgs. They will be beings who are not totally human because through genetics, through synthetic biology, we can change our, you know, DNA through genetically modified crop. So we're going to be different beings than what we are today. And if you look at what the report says, there's a reason for this. The report says that between 2007 and 2036, the world's population will have exploded to 10 billion people. Now, George, if we don't have enough food today for all of us on the planet Earth, think what's going to happen when we get to 10 billion people.
Right.
What they're saying also is that by 2036, two-thirds of the world's population will be living in areas of water stress. The lack of food, water, medicine, proper hygiene, education, basic human necessities will spell collapse, according to the report. And without mincing words, the Strategic Trends 2007-2036 report states explicitly, and I quote, "Growing gap between majority and a small number of highly visible super rich is likely to pose an increasing threat, you know, to social order and stability. The result of the growing desperation on the part of humanity will result in civil war, intercommunal violence, insurgency, pervasive criminality, widespread disorder. And the impact of this collapse, transmitted through the globalized economy, will result in a breakdown of the entire international political system and complete economic collapse. And what they're talking about, when you flip the page and you go to, I think, page 56, is that the destruction of nation states is the next logical step in this disintegration, meaning countries will disappear and will be replaced by megacities. And the report defines a megacity as a large city of a population base of at least 20 million people. Then it goes to say that caused by massive population displacement, cities will swell to unimaginable proportions, which have already experienced endemic lawlessness and high levels of violence. And then, to top it all off, the report goes on to say that the megacities themselves will fail before 2035. And the effect will be equivalent to state failure, which city failure may in turn precipitate. So this is what we're looking at. The world of Blade Runner, and it's right around the corner.
Oh,
and what people don't understand, George, because again, you hear what people say, and they still talk about microchips in your hand and the mark of the beast. They don't understand that we're standing at the cusp of the greatest change in the history of mankind, that what the generations from now on will look nothing like the human beings we're accustomed to being today.
My gosh, that's a horrible projected thought there. They're going to just destroy humankind.
Well, you know, it's not exactly like that. You see, it gets a little tricky here.
Okay.
Now, let me explain. You see, on the one hand, if you go back in time, let's say, you know, 6,000 years ago, who controlled knowledge of the world? The high priests.
Yes.
And what the high priests did is they gave it to us one little droplet at a time. Now, today, this whole, you know, pyramidal structure of control has been reversed because of the information revolution. Anyone with access to internet has the knowledge of the entire history of mankind at their fingerprints, or the fingertips, sorry.
Right.
Which means that if you're the elite, all these things that you've uncovered and discovered and talked about in secret gatherings of like-minded, super powerful men and women, now anybody, whether you're, you know, an Aborigine, you know, an American Indian, a millionaire, you know, a Koya Indian sitting on a, you know, in the middle of a rainforest in Bolivia, you know, on a tree, we all have access to the same information. So if you're the elite, that's, you know, it doesn't really, you know, it's not to their liking. It's a bit of a bummer. So what they have done is they're using their incredible wealth, which is quadrillions of.
It's quite a bit, isn't it? Yeah.
Is bigger than ever, using technology, which is very expensive.
Right.
You know, and creating this divide. So on the one hand, they're destroying the world's economy on purpose, as you see all around us. The United States, Canada, Europe, Spain, Greece, Portugal, you know, Italy, Northern Europe, South America, look at Argentina, look at, you know, Venezuela, Africa, you know, look at Southeast Asia. The world is being, you know, is going to hell in a handbasket. It's financial meltdown of the entire world financial system. And this is being done on purpose by the man behind the curtain. And the reason this is being done on purpose is that the powerful men understand that progress and development is directly proportional to population density. If we have progress, there's going to be a lot more people. But you need progress because what you have today, what you have today, is a population base of 7 billion. And unless we have progress, there's no way you can sustain that population base without some kind of a meltdown and a drop in the population, because you need technology, you know, to give food and water and you know, to so many people.
Right.
So on one hand, they're destroying this. And look at the United States, Detroit. That's a great example. I mean, a city which has been called a motor city today looks like, you know, some post-apocalyptic city you know, at the end of the world. It looks exactly like what Dresden did look like right at the end of World War II. And this is being done on purpose. So on the one hand, they're destroying the economy. But on the other hand, they're making sure that although we are going to hell, they are using the technology to conquer space, which is one of the reasons, for example, you know, if you pay attention, the Dutch are getting ready by 2018, that's 3.5 years from now, to send a manned, you know, mission to Mars on a one-way ticket.
Right.
These pioneers will conquer Mars and live there forever until they die. The yeah. Russian and the European Space Agency are getting ready to conquer Mars in 2023. Private corporations are getting ready to go to the moon and to conquer the asteroids. Couldn't get the word out of my mouth. Because asteroids are full of natural resources. So, you know, they're sending us to hell while they're conquering space. How's that for an alternative?
Yeah. Are we, have we become the enemy, Daniel? The people?
We have, you know, that's a very good question. You know, I hate to say it, but all these technologies that we see around us are not being developed to stop the terrorists. They're being stopped, you know, developed to stop you and me and us, the people. The laws to justify these technologies were not written on a whim. They're specifically designed to give the government carte blanche authority over the people during the chaos and confusion of the age of transition. Transition to a planetary civilization. The Bin Ladens, the Gaddafis, the Assads. Who said that they were the enemy? They're not my enemy. They didn't have, never did anything to me. They're not our enemy. We the, are the enemy of the government. And whether you're at the airport, at water crossings, street corners, from now on, this powerful technology which is being developed as we speak, you know, will mind probe us. And all this stuff is being developed by the Human Factors Division of the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate.
Yeah, it looked like they've developed self-protecting networks, see, and that are protecting themselves. And they're alerting through their intelligence operations and all this social engineering and social media networks who is going to be the rebellious ones against their system.
You know, the... that's all part of the psychological warfare.
Right.
And the reason I say that is, you know, social media is a great way to gauge people's opinions, and
yes.
Then you can maneuver it into making them believe what you want them to believe. And that works because, unfortunately, most Americans, you know, think that there's such a thing as free press. Of course, free press doesn't exist in the United States because the media, whether you're a journalist, whether you're an editor, an executive editor, they're paid employees and serve the media owners whose ownership is run through directorates and who's run the directorate themselves around through the board of directors who are themselves run through the shareholders. And the shares of these companies, such as New York Times, Washington Post, they're traded on Wall Street. In other words, the people who own the media tell us what to think. And if you look at some of the corporations such as Chase Manhattan Bank and other, you know, large banks, they own big chunks of the America's leading media corporations like New York Times, Washington Post, Fox, etc. Why? Because, you know, if America's leading media corporations decide one day, because they just decided one day, to tell the truth about how biggest banks in the world, you know, are in the business of money laundering and drug trafficking, well, being the biggest owner of the shares of the company, if you are Chase Manhattan Bank or Bank of America or Citigroup, will certainly put a stop to any of these attempts to tell the truth in a hurry.
Well, there was something that surprised me at the Davos meeting, which concluded last weekend. They had Rick Perry, governor of Texas, on this panel discussion. It was on drugs, you know, on legalization and decriminalization. Also on there was the president of Colombia, President Santos. What came up in their discussion was that Rick Perry brought it up that the banks are irresponsible in continuing to laundry the money through their banking system, and then President Santos seconded that idea and said, yeah, in Colombia, when we go after the money, we run up against a wall. Now, that's something else, isn't it?
Well, you know, the drug money has always been the the lubricant of the world economy. You're looking at a $900 billion-dollar operation. And it's just an incredible amount of money, how much is out there. And the point is that, you know, this money is part of the system. And you cannot take it out of the system, because if you did, the entire world economy will collapse onto itself. Which is why, you know, because drugs, you launder it through the financial markets. They feed the economy. The corporations use that money, for their balance sheets. For example, let me give you an example.
Okay.
You take any corporation in the world. How do you determine, their stock value? Why is a Bank of America is worth whatever they're worth, $20, and Disney is $164, and another corporation $16.48? Well, economists use this formula called POP, price per benefit. And a healthy price per benefit POP ratio is about 30-1. Just to give an idea, Enron, when it collapsed, was 90-1. So for every $90, one was benefit. Doesn't work that way. Then, the healthy benefit is 30-1. So when they come up with these, share numbers, that's how usually, the works on this basis.
Right.
So if you take it as a purely mathematical formula, 30-1 is the same as 60-2, 90-3, 120-4, 150-5. So if I have 5 million, 10 million, or whatever million dollars, which I can make from drug trade, and I plug it into this 30-1 ratio, I have $300 million I can use to play in the stock market.
My gosh. See,
so you could never take the money out of if you did, the entire world economy would collapse onto itself, which is, again, Bank of Wachovia caught with their pants down laundering Mexican cartels billions of dollars. And the president comes out and says, I don't know what happened. Well, who the hell believes this nonsense? Citibank, Hongxiang, world's oldest money laundering operation.
HSBC, right, yeah.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we saw them front and center last summer. These operations, they're money-making operations run, through the British Empire, through London, through Wall Street, which is just another corporation. It's nominally American.
Right, you make a good point about the City of London. You were talking about the opium dealing into China, but the City of London's been the money power for centuries, has it not, or for a couple of centuries?
Well, exactly, but the reason for that is that what's today called the Venetian Black Nobility.
Yes,
it was then called the Venetian Black Nobility. It's actually that, and the whole point of what Venice is today is Venice, the Venetian operation, just came to the point where they simply migrated their operations to the Netherlands and to England, which is why, again, these are the seats of power of the Bilderberg inner circle, the Queen of England and the Queen of the Netherlands, Queen Beatrice. Now she's Princess Beatrice because her daughter became the queen. But the point is that this Venetian operation has been ongoing since the middle of the 14th century.
So you're talking about the Black Nobility here. That's another term for it, is it not?
Exactly, the Venetian Black Nobility, which begins about the time of the Fourth Crusade, which is about 1204.
So money operations were needed on trade, and as trade built up internationally, then the money operations and the international financiers, they all prospered.
Exactly. They did until a point in time in 1345 when the entire system collapsed. And that was the great collapse of 1345, which brought as I guess you could say Christmas present, the bubonic plague that wiped out anywhere between a third and a half of European population.
Right.
So these are the kinds of people we have running the world today. It's still the same operation. It hasn't changed. Okay. You could look, and again, I think it's fair to say that, if you look at Bilderberg, and Venetian Black Nobility, Bilderberg is one of these organizations that were established in the modern period as a continuation of methods of Venice. For example, what's this whole system of private tax-exempt foundations in the United States and Europe? These are your old Venetian fondies, the private oligarchical funds that are exempted from the kind of taxes they will be paying in a system of sovereign nation states. and the funds are deployed to exert control over policy through methods that are not to be direct and obvious to people stuck in, you know, in a certain certainty.
Right. You know, the Hollywood has these movies out that support everything you've been saying, like the Terminator, Blade Runner, RoboCop, and all this. They're very powerful vehicles, are they not, in this modern sense?
You know, Hollywood is an amazing industry itself. You know, it makes great movies. But if you actually...
Yeah.
Corporations. They're some of the world's most powerful corporate dictatorships, you would call it, You know, and Hollywood is a great gauger of future trends. Now, I'm not talking about some lovey-dovey love film. I'm talking about, you know, technological films.
Yes.
If you look at films like, you know, G.I. Joe 2, which uses a lot of the technology which I talk about in my book, such as nanotechnology, Prototype, which talks about singularity, Transcendence, that's a film that's coming out right now shortly with Johnny Depp, and that's a great film, and they talk about uploading your mind, and, you know, the premise of the film is Johnny Depp is a great scientist who's shot by someone, you know, some radical movement terrorists who are against technological progress, and this man's body is dying, but his mind is awake, and what they do is they upload his mind onto a computer. And he lives, and he tries to take over the entire planet.
Golly, man.
And, you know, the whole point of this transhumanist movement is the idea of projects such as Russia 2045, is the idea to be able to do this, because for the elite, immortality and for us immortality are two very different concepts. You know, you and I may understand immortality as, well, we don't, you know, we age a little bit, but we live through the ages, centuries, and you're basically looking the same. But for the elite, immortality has nothing to do with your body, physical body, which dies anyway. It's the idea of uploading your mind into a cyberspace and living forever in cyberspace. So if you look, for example, at some of these films like Transcendence, that's a good one. I can't wait to see it. Gattaca, that was an old film from a few years back with Jude Law. And that was a great film about actually a whole thing of synthetic biology. Public Enemy with Will Smith about all the NSA technology. The movie Moon, that was a good one. That's, you know, really low budget. If people haven't seen it, I advise you to watch it. Moon, it's called. Minority Report with Tom Cruise. Technology they use in that report, in Minority Report, sorry. It's already up and running. Avatar, there's a movie from, you know, a couple of years back. Well, the idea of the transhumanist movement is to upload your brain by 2045 into an avatar of your choosing. You don't have to be a human being anymore. You could be, I don't know, an insect with your consciousness, which is why I said again, this is the last generation of human beings on the planet Earth. There's a video game called Deus Ex, D-E-U-S, and then the second word is E-X. It is the best, greatest, most interesting, exhilarating video game in the world. Not because I play video games, because I don't. But what it represents as far as one world government, new world order, control, Illuminati, it's an amazing game. You know, if you go back, like, you know, I don't know, did you see the Minority Report with Tom Cruise?
No, I didn't. I didn't see that.
Well, you know, in that film, Tom Cruise's character, John Anderton,
okay,
had this radical surgery to replace his eyes so that he can get past security systems that scan his retina to identify him, because the Minority Report is about pre-crime, detecting criminals before they commit a crime. And so, you know, while Tom Cruise is lying in the stub, recovering from his black market operation, these tiny little robots sneak into the room and scan his eyes in an attempt to track down the fugitive future crime officer. And so the ability to scan retina to identify people is straight out of science fiction. But outside of these little spider-like drone bots, it is very much, very much present and actual. And then there's another film, Men in Black, which is like, you know, a really famous film about, you know, aliens and stuff, with Will Smith and I can't remember the other actor's name. And they use this technology called amnesia beam, where they say, you didn't see this, these animals or these aliens that you just saw, they weren't there, they kind of, you know, put their black, dark glasses on. They put this little thingy up. It looks like a pen. They flash it, and then you forget everything that you saw. Well, it's called amnesia beam, and it is here. ready to be used at moment's notice. And what's more, a team of neuroscientists has actually developed a brain scan based on finding hints about what a subject is intending to do. And this is a nightmare.
Yeah, this is dangerous stuff, isn't it, Daniel?
Well, let's take it one step further.
Yeah, go ahead. Explain.
Fox Television, okay, a new series is coming up right now. Oh, I think it's already out. Called Almost Human, where one of the main characters is a cyborg cop. Now, neuroscience, okay, is the study of nervous system. With advances in chemistry and computer science and engineering and medicine and other disciplines, neuroscience now also includes the study of the molecular, cellular, developmental, structural, functional, evolutionary, computational, and medical aspects of the nervous system. From molecular and cellular studies of individual nerve cells to imaging of sensory and motor tasks in the brain, neuroscience has literally crossed the threshold of science and has become a key element of national security apparatus the world over. And, you know, these technologies, again, okay, are not being developed to stop the terrorists. They're being developed to stop us, the people, okay? They're sophisticated elements of neural weaponry created, you know, to perpetuate a state of uncertainty in this age of demand destruction the world over that the Strategic Trends Report talked about that I mentioned earlier in our
Right. We have that Strategic Trends Report up on our site, and we have links up to all your pages and stuff also on there. And you can email me anything else you might want up on your
site
for your program tonight, you know. But you really know your subject here, Daniel. And how does this nanotechnology figure into this? Is that one part that they're making great strides and advances in?
You know, nano is a big game changer right now. It's very new. Now, nano is a space measured between one atom and about 400 atoms. Now, if you think of the planet Earth, just to give you a kind of an idea of what it looks like.
Okay.
If you think of Earth on a new scale, a billionth of a meter. Okay? So the distance between the moon and the Earth is about a billion meters. That's a day's travel.
Okay.
The distance between a meter and a billionth of a meter is exactly the same, but it takes a few seconds. It takes you into this nano world. And a nanometer is 100,000 times smaller than your hair. And what happens is, at a nanometer scale, everyday materials, you know, start to act in unimaginable ways. The behavior of nanomaterials, scientists discovered, can change when size becomes so small as compared with a larger amount of that same material. It is a space in which quantum behavior replaces Newtonian physics. You see, in any direction you go, big or small, if you go far enough, you hit limits set by physical law. Okay, it's called Moore's law, quantum mechanics, speed of light, gravitational forces. But with the advent of this new science and technology related to the genetic revolution, we can literally rewrite our genetic construct. And in the span of a generation, if you think about it, George, we have gone from genetically modified plants to genetically modified animals. And the next step is genetically modified humans.
Well, that DNA then can be changed, can it? And be reprogrammed, rewritten. Is that right?
Oh, this is absolutely right. This is exactly what is being done. And one of the biggest breakthroughs in recent history, scientists have created a synthetic genome that can self-replicate. What they've done is they've taken a cell and modified the genes of a cell by inserting DNA from another organism, and the bacteria replicated itself, thus creating a second generation of a synthetic DNA. Now, this organism will do exactly what scientists intended to do. A living thing, but under the control of man. So, you know, if you go back a little bit, the 19th century was, you know, the revolution of harnessing energy from fossil fuels. The 20th century was about exploiting the power of data. Well, this century is about controlling biology.
Yes, it is.
And if you can control biology, you can create life in a laboratory. You can create beings that never existed on the planet Earth, which is why, again, I said, we're going to have not humans, but beings are absolutely new, you know, in our ecosystem.
My gosh. There's been some new breakthroughs and that I picked up on yesterday and gave me feedback on this, but there's something about a normal cell can be converted under certain stress situations into a stem cell. Have you heard such a thing lately? This is some new technology or discovery.
Well, it's, again, you know, they're talking about synthetic genes.
Yeah, okay, right.
They've been inserted into bacterium, which had its own original DNA stripped out. You know, they're talking about the DNA, the RNAs as the substitutes that are called exonases. Without getting into too much detail, you see, on Earth, I'll try to explain it. Okay. On Earth, all life depends upon the nucleic acid, DNA, and RNA. The DNA is a code for life. You know, these twisting strands that hold the genes of everything on Earth.
Okay.
Which essentially comes down to four basic molecules, a long polymer of sugars linked together by a phosphate. You know, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, better known by their first letters, ACGT. It is the order of these that conveys genetic information. And because these molecules are well understood, they can be manufactured synthetically and rearranged to design brand new genes. And this is what is being done.
Well, now, IBM is trying to duplicate the human storage of the brain. Is that not with some kind of thing like you're talking about here? Some technology? I think IBM is working in an area of memory storage that duplicates or something replicates closely the human brain cell to store or whatever. Is that right?
They're still pretty far away. But, you know, the whole point of this is they're doing exactly what the transhumanist movement has been trying to do for a very, very long time.
Yes.
You know, there's this group of people call themselves Russia 2045 movement, which is a transhumanist movement. And it's led by, you know, an icon of the transhumanist movement is a guy by the name of Ray Kurzweil, one of the greatest inventors, you could say, of the 20th century. And he's also the boss of the tech division for Google, which means he has the money and the power behind him to actually get anything done. And what these people are thinking about doing is that they are convinced that by 2035, that's in 20 years from now, that's nothing. You know, the scientists or science will come very close to understanding the principles of consciousness, okay? And that by 2035, the first successful attempt to transfer one's personality to an avatar, which is an alternative carrier, will take place. And they call this period the epoch of cybernetic immortality. It's the beginning of this period. So in one generation, bodies made of nanorobots will be able to take shape or rise alongside hologram bodies. By 2045, they're convinced we will see drastic changes in social structure. And the main priority of this development is spiritual self-improvement, as they call it, a new era of neo-humanity. And basically what these people want to do is to incrementally move the human mind into a more disembodied and, I guess you could say, futuristic vehicles. First, a humanoid robot controlled entirely by human brain via brain-machine interface. Then a conscious human brain transplanted into a humanoid robot. Then consciousness itself uploaded to a computer. And finally, a hologram that contains a full conscious human mind. You know, this may seem futuristic, but these people are literally creating a new vector for civilization by integrating new deliveries, discoveries, and development from science, physics, energetics, bioengineering, cognitive sciences, neurology, aeronautics, nanotechnology. You know, so all of this stuff is being done right now because, again, of very powerful logarithms and because of the very powerful, you know, processing chips, we can store all this information, combine it with everything which is being discovered worldwide, and create things at a speed which we have never, you know, thought possible because, you know, in the last 50 years, we have discovered more and learned more about the history of mankind than in all of human history up until that point. Well, in the next 20, George, we will have learned more than in these 50 than in all of the history of mankind. And this is going to get to a point in about a generation and a half from now where everything we will have learned will be doubling every year or every 6 months. I don't know. That's one of the things about my new book, Transevolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, is that, well, there's a Bilderberg. It was all very neat. You started, you read the whole thing, you finished, you knew the names, the faces. You said, okay, they're bad people. We have to fight them. But in this book, when you finish the book, you have more questions than answers because we're talking about the future. Yeah. You can extrapolate knowledge, but you can't predict exactly where it's going to go in the next few years. We know where it's going. We know we're going to be conquering galaxies. We're going to be conquering the moon and asteroids and going to live on Mars. There's no doubt about that. Strategic Trends Report talks about that. By 2050, we will be living on Mars in large numbers. That's 35 years from now.
God, that's a short time. We've got about 5 minutes left. Is there anything that we've covered so much? And Daniel, you're just a genius, a person here. You have such a vast knowledge on multiple levels. We got about 4.5 minutes. So is there anything to wrap up the program that we sort of left out and didn't cover?
Yeah, there's one thing I'm going to talk about. It's called hive mind.
Okay.
Now, transhumanists have a popular term called hive mind.
Okay.
Which refers to the giant collective intelligence that might be created when people all over the world link their brains together with technology. In other words, creating a whole new intelligence through symbiotic existence. It is this human beehive which has been the ideal society in the eyes of the elite for a very long time.
Okay.
It is a template for post-humanity. The ultimate slave race, scientifically designed to never rebel, and the wholesale disappearance of the human being with his and her divine spark of reason at the expense of group speak, group think, and group action. And if people think that this doesn't happen, or won't happen, or won't be happening, well, we already have a much, more basic version of hive mind. You can call it cloud on your computer where you store all your files. Well, it's another version of cloud, except that the technology used will increasingly dominate the world as population, resources, and potential social conflict grows. Therefore, the success of this convergent technologies priority area is essential, to the future of humanity as far as the elite are concerned. And what they're trying to do is, transhumanism fills people's hopes and minds with dreams of becoming superhuman. But the fact of the matter is that the true goal is the removal of that pesky human free will itself. And this post-humanity will be a new human which has been genetically engineered and brain-chipped for total control. It will be part man, it will be part machine, but this new individual will no longer have a need of the sexual reproduction function. And if you're the elite and you want to reduce the world's population, I can't think of a better way to do this. But, as the final thought, there's nothing that equals in the universe our divine spark of reason. And no matter how hard they try, they will never be able to replicate it. And the greatest natural resource of the planet Earth is not oil or gas. It's the collective intelligence of 7 billion people on a planet who work towards, a good end by discovering universal principles of nature which improve the lives of everybody on the planet per square kilometer of space against that nature. They will not succeed.
Well, I like that. They've drawn upon Plato, have they not, with this universal mind or soul or whatever idea?
And
they parlayed that into where they're at today, right?
They've drawn upon Aristotle's. Plato and Socrates are on our side.
Yeah, okay. But in this thinking, then there this hive thinking, Kurt Lewin seems to come to my mind out of England by way of Germany and Tavistock,
Oh, exactly.
He pioneered in this group management and group think,
Cybernetics, exactly.
Yeah, so we certainly enjoyed our conversation tonight with you, Daniel Estulin, and we're going to highly recommend your book to everyone on our site and so forth. And tell us where we can get that on your site. What is your site name?
You can get it. You can get it through Amazon, or you can get it through my publisher, Trine Day. Chris Milliken, a great man, my publisher.
Okay, we'll put it up there, too. You bet.
Yeah, absolutely. TrineDay.com, or you can get it via Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's available in all the bookstores across the country. And just goes to show you that no matter how hard the elite work to make sure that this kind of information doesn't get out into the public, you know, it's out there and they can't stop it.
Boy, Daniel Estevan, thank you for all your hard work and everything. We certainly enjoyed the conversation and the interview this evening. And that's Trans Evolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, written by Daniel Estevan, a fine author and a fine person. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, sir. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you again, Daniel Estevan. Boy, that was quite an interview. It's been reported by Infowars.com, Paul Joseph Watson writing for Infowars.com. A third banker has committed suicide within the space of a week, once again prompting speculation that some kind of financial collapse could just be right around the corner. Mike Drucker, the chief economist at Russell Investments, was found dead on the side of a highway that leads to the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in Washington State. According to Pierce County Sheriff's Department, he was 50 years old, reported Bloomberg. So, I mean, he said that he fell off a 50-foot embankment, and what police are describing as a suicide. He was reported missing on January 29th by friends who said he had been having problems at work. Drucker's apparent suicide follows those of London banking executives Gabriel Maggie and Bill Broschmidt. Maggie, a 39-year-old senior manager at J.P. Morgan's European headquarters, jumped 500 feet from the top of the bank's headquarters in central London on Tuesday, landing on an adjacent 9-story roof. My gosh, what a way to go. Last Sunday, former Deutsche Bank executive Broschmidt was found dead at his South Kensington home after police responded to reports of a man found hanging at a house, according to reports. Broschmidt had close ties to chief executive Anshu Jain. So, I mean, there's more and more intrigue, isn't there? In addition, it goes on to say, the article, a UK-based communications director at Swiss REAG also died last week, but the cause of death has not been determined. And that's about all we'll cover there. I mean, this throws the uproar that's happening out here is reminiscent of a possible introduction to a major banking crisis of some kind. If they were banks and they had some special inside knowledge, then this could be the problem that we're running into with these bankers, maybe having either there were improprieties on their part or they were aware of improprieties. These suicides just don't happen at the top like that for no good reason. So it's very possible that these men were involved in some kind of problem, either home, marital, or banking scandal that is brewing or is finally coming to light. But anyway, we want to thank our listening audience there again in Austin. We're going to have the Fukushima Solutions World Conference on March 8th and 9th. Look for that on FukushimaSolutions.com. Look at FukushimaSolutions.com. And thank you for listening tonight. We certainly appreciate each and every one of our listeners. Good night.